to the political cesspool known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
And welcome, everyone, to the Political Cesspool Radio Program. I'm your host, James Edwards. Saturday, September 17th, and I'm calling in to the radio station live this evening from Knoxville, Tennessee. I'm wrapping up my mini speaking tour. I say mini, it's been pretty major on me. You know, I'm not a rock and roll band, and I'm not a professional politician, so to have been on the road for 13 out of the past 17 days is pretty extensive for yours truly. And we're wrapping up everything tonight from Knoxville. I just finished a little bit earlier this afternoon speaking to the Practical Politics and Leadership Seminar, which has been sponsored by the Derek Black Show, which airs Monday through Friday on AM 1340 WPBR in West Palm Beach, Florida. Had a great, great time here today, and hopefully later on in the show, during tonight's second and third hours, we will hear from some of the speakers that shared the stage with me this beautiful afternoon in East Tennessee. They're actually still wrapping up the conference. I had to leave a little bit earlier to get back into my hotel room so I could call in and host the show from afar. Of course, our staff and crew at our flagship station, AM 1380 WLRM Radio in Memphis, Tennessee, are there making sure everything goes off without a hitch tonight, as is our crack team in Utah with Liberty News Radio, all making sure that my report this evening from the hotel in Knoxville goes out to our flagship and affiliate stations without any compromise whatsoever. Again, ladies and gentlemen, it is great to be with you tonight. I set out on this speaking tour on Thursday, September the 1st. It was actually not far from where I am now. The first engagement that I had was to a Republican club here in East Tennessee, not far from Knoxville. Of course, there were a couple of other small stops in between. The two major ones, though, were last week. I called in last Saturday night from Washington, D.C., where I spoke to the National Policy Institute Conference, gave a speech at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and then, of course, tonight it's all wrapping up here in Knoxville, and I couldn't be happier. I'm happy for many reasons. Number one, I have met so many great people over the course of the last 2.5-3 weeks. Like I said, I've only been home for 4 days this month, so home will never have looked so good by the time I get there tomorrow night. I'll be driving back home to Memphis tomorrow for some R&R. But I tell you, so I'm excited about that, but I'm equally, if not more so, excited about the fact that I have met so many fans of the political cesspool over the last few days. And, folks, I could not love you anymore. Y'all are outstanding, outstanding fine people. The more I say it, the more true it is, because every time I say it on the heels of just having an interaction or an exchange with some of you. And again, just like last week in Washington and some of the other smaller stops that I've made today, you know, the firm, robust handshakes from the men who listen to this show, to have been able to sign some books for you, to take some pictures with you. You know, of course, I'm always happy to do that. And, you know, just see that look in your eye of appreciation for the work that this staff does in bringing you this show each and every Saturday night. Keith Alexander, by the way. Now, Keith Alexander, Bill Rowland, Winston Smith, Eddie the Bombiter Miller, many of you have been asking about them when you saw me over the course of this tour. They are all doing well. They all have the night off tonight. I'm going to be handling the whole program this evening. Keith Alexander, you know, he never misses. And he didn't miss tonight. I almost forced his hand. I said, you know, listen, I've been out. I've been traveling. I've been doing this. Why don't you take the night off, a well-deserved night off? And so he took me up on that, and I'm sure he'll be frothing at the mouth to get back on the air next week. But Keith Alexander will indeed be back next week. He has the night off. But anyway, you know, great, great month for me. It certainly reaffirms everything that I already knew to be true, that we have a listening audience that is second to none in character, in intelligence, in support. You know, I brought a box of books today to the meeting. I'm not taking any of them back to Memphis, so let me just put it that way. And it's been that sort of hearty reception every stop I have made over the course of the last 17 days. When people started writing and emailing and calling me earlier this year to see if I could come and speak to their group. I wanted to try to cluster everything around the two big events, which was, of course, today in Knoxville and last week in Washington, and I was able to group everything to where I could knock everything out in short order. So it's been a very tiring but a very exuberant couple of weeks, and I am all the better for it. We are going to talk much more about tonight's conference. Of course, we gave you a comprehensive recap of the National Policy Institute's conference last week on the show when I was phoning in from Washington. You heard from Richard Spencer. You heard from Sam Dixon. You heard from Jared Taylor. And, of course, I was recounting the experience of last week. We're going to be doing something very similar this evening, again, ladies and gentlemen, doing the second and third hour. I'm not going to tell you who you're going to hear from because, to be quite honest with you, I don't even know who you're going to hear from. But I've got everybody's phone number. We're going to make a few calls. We're going to have our producer and board operator make a few calls during the second and third hour, and we're just going to see who we get on the phone. But whoever it is, I can promise you one thing. You are going to enjoy listening to what they have to say. I guarantee you that. And in fact, you know, I want to keep you, I want to build the suspense for just a moment. I don't want to tell you who we're going to be getting on the show later. I want you to stay tuned for it. Now, I don't think it's going to disappoint you. Certainly people who have been on the show before, some recently, some not so recently, you're going to love them because I was listening to their speeches today and I was like, you know, if I only could have broadcast the entire show from the conference hall, if only I could, you know, encapsulate these talks that are so powerful, so moving, so inspiring, and just, you know, use their speeches today to fill my 3 hours this evening, I could have done no better than that to bring you the perfect show tonight. This was an incredible way to cap off my travels this fall. You know, I haven't done a radio program, I haven't done a broadcast from our home studio since the last Saturday of August. Since then, I've been on the road each and every week, you know, doing this. And anyway, next week I'll be back. Next week we'll be back to you know, the normal format. But coming up a little later tonight, folks, you're going to really enjoy what you're going to hear. And for the remainder of this hour, though, for those of you who have not been able to join me at any of my stops this month, I'm going to share with you the speech that I gave, kind of a condensed version, I guess it will be, and of course with commercial breaks in between. This is talk radio, after all. But for those of you who have not been able to join me on the road this month, I'm going to share with you the speech that I've given at these stops, and hopefully you will enjoy it and be able to take something from it as it appeared the live audiences that I've enjoyed have done this month. And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, we are also, one last announcement here before we take our first commercial break, also running our fall fundraising drive right now. Don't forget us. We need your support in order to continue our work, which, again, by all accounts, many of you are enjoying. Go to thepoliticalcesspool.org. If you make a donation of $100 or more between now and the end of the month, you'll get an autographed copy of Kevin MacDonald's book, Cultural Insurrection. Donate tonight. Stay tuned for more. I'm James Edwards, and I'll be back with you right after these words.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Where I'm calling in tonight from a very nice hotel room in Knoxville, Tennessee, at the foot of the Great Smoky Mountains, where I'm wrapping up my fall speaking tour. I said at the opening of the show, I felt, you know, the fact that I've been on the road 13 out of the last 17 days certainly wouldn't, you know, be much of a stretch for a, you know, for a musical band. But I actually do feel a little bit like a musical band. You know, they'll do a concert in Orlando, followed the next night in Tampa, then Miami. A different city every night, but it's always the same show. It's always the same set. And so I do have a little bit of a similarity there because I've made a lot of stops over the course of the last couple of weeks. But it's always been the same speech. But it's been very well received everywhere I've gone, and it was new to the audience. You know, the same the audience that was here today in Knoxville wasn't the same audience that I had the opportunity to speak to last week in Washington. And so for the benefit of you who are listening tonight from all over the country and indeed around the world on the internet at thepoliticalcesspool.org, I would like to actually, you know, share with you some of the remarks that I made in my talk. If you were with me in Washington or at any of the other stops and you've already heard it, you know, indulge me, but I'm sure there's a lot of people here who haven't. And basically in all of these stops that I've made, I've been asked to talk about racism. What passes for racism in Obama's America. And, of course, I always opened up the speech with a little crack that, you know, I was asked by this group, this particular group, to come and talk on this subject because I'm an expert on it. You know, very few people in this country have suffered the name-calling that I have. Very few people have been called a racist, you know, falsely accused of racism more than me. And, of course, I'm called a racist simply because I love my family. I love my family. I love my extended family, which is, you know, our race, and I'm proud of our accomplishments, the great intellectual gifts and scientific advancements that have been bestowed upon civilization by European mankind. This is, in fact, the greatest double standard in all of politics. There are no shortage of groups that seek to advance the interests of black people or Jewish people or Hispanic people or even homosexuals. There are no shortages of organizations that seek to safeguard, you know, obscure species of animals or even plants. But yet, if you tell them that, as I do, yes, you know, I am a pro-white advocate. You know, I use my radio program to advance the interests of European Americans. Well, then, you know, you are evil. You are the embodiment of all that is wrong with the world. But yet, when these other groups do that, they're not only allowed to do it, but they're encouraged to do it. And this is something that, you know, obviously I'm not going to stand for. For the last 7 years, I've been fighting against this double standard, this hypocrisy, from my bully pulpit here on the national syndicated airwaves. But according to the media, you know, racism is more rampant today than at any point in our nation's history. There's more accusations of racism today than there was, you know, during the days of segregation and Jim Crow. They say this, of course, that there's more racism prevalent today in America than ever before. This, of course, you know, after 50 years and untold trillions of dollars have been spent on welfare and food stamps, rent supplements, Section 8 housing, Pell Grants, student loans, legal services for minorities, Medicaid, and other poverty programs designed to bring the black community into the mainstream, yet still they say the specter of racism lurks behind every corner. Well, we've all heard the grievances, but what about the gratitude? Where's the gratitude for all that the West has done for civilization across the borders and around the world, of, you know, medicine and education, you know, cars, air flight, you name it, probably came from those evil racists. But, you know, that's why racism is one of the marvels of modern science. It's everywhere. It's kind of like oxygen and gravity and other sorts of natural occurring wonders. And just like those mysterious forces and substances, racism is practically invisible, you know, to people like us. Thankfully, Mother Nature has generously provided us with non-whites and white liberals with special sensors that enable them to detect this insidious and invisible force everywhere it's found. And these days, it's literally found everywhere. And speaking at these different stops across my tour, I basically presented them a speech that detailed my book in a concise and again, condensed fashion. And this is what Racism Schmacism, in my book, which was released last year, this is the topic that it dealt with. And one of my main thesis in the book is, that the definition of racism itself has changed over the years. No longer does racism mean a person who has an irrational hate for others who are not of their culture, or an irrational hatred of others who are of a different skin color. That's not what racism is anymore. That's what it used to be, maybe. But today, quite simply, the definition of racist is a white person. This is what I've been telling people in these speeches. Racism is anything that a white person does that a liberal or establishment conservative doesn't like. Many of you who are fans of this show have seen my appearances on CNN. We have some of them archived at our website, again, thepoliticalcesspool.org. Just go to the video tab. My first appearance on CNN, I was there to debate the merits of self-segregation. One of my counterparts across the table was a white liberal, apparently, and she said that, yes, in fact, that is true. All whites are born racist. If you are white, you are born a racist. But if you work really hard at it, as she is trying to do, perhaps, if you're lucky, you'll die a little less racist than you were when you came into the world. Well, of course, this is nonsense, but that doesn't stop it from being an effective tactic. That's why these radical egalitarians hurl these baseless accusations of racism, because they've discovered that it's a very powerful political weapon that can be used to squash dissent and shame traditional Americans. Tossing out the R word is all they have to do to stifle healthy conversation and debate. Yeah. It's kind of like the new scarlet letter. No longer is it an A for adultery, it's R for racism. That's the worst thing you could be. But then again, everybody that's white is a racist, according to the modern-day definition. And it's irrelevant, though, honestly, whether or not the accusation is true, because, they don't care if you are or not. The entire purpose that they call you these words, if you're a conservative white, the whole reason they launch these verbal attacks is to put you on the sideline. None of us want to be hated, but so many of us spend more time debating a losing argument than staying focused on the issue that animated us in the first place. Why European Americans have allowed cultural Marxists to have this power over us can be debated, but the fact that the charges of racism are being used as a socio-political nuclear bomb cannot be questioned. I'm going to offer you just a few points over the course of these next couple of segments out of thousands of examples I could have chosen from to prove my point. John McCain is one thing that I always like to look at. And this guy, you remember him. Liberal, open borders, politically correct prototype. In 2008, he ran the most wimpy and apologetic presidential campaign in American history, ever. And the GOP would have been better served by nominating a resurrected cadaver to run against Obama, because McCain refused to do the one thing necessary in order to win, which was to go after Obama in a cutthroat political mentality, as he would have done any other opponent had they been white, and hit Obama where he was the most vulnerable, which was, of course, his relationship with the white-hating and America-hating Jeremiah Wright. But, McCain didn't do that. In fact, he spent most of his time on the campaign trail complimenting Obama because he was terrified that he might be called a dirty name by a black man. He would have rather lost the election than be called racist. And so he did lose, and he lost badly. And guess what? He was still called a racist by the Obama campaign on numerous occasions, from everything for not voting for the Martin Luther King holiday some 30 years ago to running an ad that had Obama morphing into Britney Spears, which Obama's handler said was McCain trying to insinuate a black man hitting on a white girl. But in the end, white America still elected a black president. Pause right there. We'll pick it up in a minute. Stay tuned.
Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. We gotta get
out of this place. All right, everybody. James Edwards here with you on the Political Cesspool radio program this beautiful fall evening, Saturday, September 17th. I'm calling in from Knoxville, Tennessee. I just finished speaking to the Practical Politics and Leadership Seminar sponsored by the Derek Black radio program, AM 1340 WPBR in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I gave a talk very similar in nature to the talks I've been giving all month, including the one I gave at the National Press Club last week in Washington, D.C. I am talking about the accusations of racism and why they are so prevalent in a society that just elected a black president, of all things. And, of course, it's not about whether or not you are or are not a racist. The modern-day definition of racist simply means white person. So if you're born white, then you get it. You're a racist. So, get over it and go about your business. But I'm offering you a few examples now that I listed in my speech as to how these verbal assaults that the left, you know, volleys about are effective. And again, examples of what is passing for racism in 2011. Well, John McCain, who ran the most wimpy and apologetic campaign in presidential history, did everything he could to avoid being called a racist, but he was still called a racist because he didn't vote for Martin Luther King holiday. He ran ads that showed Obama with you know, Britney Spears, which they said was insidious. But white America still elected a black president. You know, make no mistake about it. It was the white voters that put him in office. And there they were, basking in the glow of self-congratulation for electing America's first black head of state. The honeymoon had just begun for these liberal whites, and it was a euphoric time. But that euphoria didn't last long. The honeymoon was pretty much over after newly confirmed Attorney General Eric Holder gave a big speech right after Obama's inauguration and said that, you know, when it comes to race, we're a nation of cowards. And when you get right down to it, race relations haven't improved much in 50 years. So even all those whites that just voted for Obama, yeah, they're still racist. And not only are they still racist, they're racist cowards. But that's politics. How about a few more practical examples of what is and isn't racism in Obama's America? I'm going to tell you a story about Keith Sampson. If you've read my book, Racism Schmacism, you might have heard of this guy. He's a 50-something-year-old janitor at Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis, ooey pooey. And he was cited by the university's Office for Affirmative Action because he was reading a book. Apparently he was reading this book that was found offensive by some of his black coworkers. He was reading it in their presence, so they went in and complained to the administrator of affirmative action there at the university. And Mr. Sampson, a white 50-year-old janitor, was reprimanded for reading this book in their presence. So what book was he reading? Was it some, you know, evil, racist, Nazi tome? No. The title of the book was Notre Dame versus the Klan, How the Fighting Irish Helped Defeat the KKK. It was a book about how Northern whites helped eradicate the Ku Klux Klan. It was an anti-Klan book. And so, you know, naturally when he got called into the administrator's office, he said, no, you got it all wrong. This isn't an anti-black book. It's an anti-Klan book. You know, I'm on your side here. And the Office of Affirmative Action there at the university, you know, took his comments and then, you know, deliberated and made a decision. And this is what they said. They responded to him in a letter after they had heard his side of the story as well as the complaint. And they said, they wrote to Mr. Sampson, and I quote, "Upon review of this matter, we conclude that your conduct does indeed constitute racial harassment and that you demonstrated disdain and insensitivity to your coworkers who repeatedly requested that you refrain from reading the book, which has such an inflammatory and offensive topic in their presence. You used extremely poor judgment by insisting that openly reading the book related to a historically and racially abhorrent subject in the presence of your black co-workers. A majority of adults are aware and understand how repugnant the KKK is to African Americans, their reactions to the Klan, and the reasonableness of the request that you not read the book in their presence. Please be advised that any future substantiated conduct of a similar nature will result in serious disciplinary action." I mean, what planet do these people live on? It was an anti-Klan book, but just because the words Ku Klux Klan were in the title, blacks were offended. This is how far removed from reality a lot of these accusations of racism are. Now, let's travel. That was an incident that happened in Indiana. Let's now allow our travels to take us from Indiana to Columbus, Georgia, where a couple of years ago, they were having a civil rights march, if you will call it that, that it was being planned on Martin Luther King Day of that year. And because a big crowd was expected, the city of Columbus, Georgia, assigned some traffic cops to help keep the traffic moving, help make sure the people that were marching didn't get run over. You know, sounds reasonable, right? You assign police officers to help handle the crowd. Well, apparently, a couple of white police officers got totally out of hand. They did something absolutely horrific in the presence of some of these black civil rights marchers. If you read the book again, you know what they did. But if you haven't read it yet, or if you just need to be reminded, let me share it with you now. What were these two white police officers doing that upset these black people so badly? Were they, you know, shouting racial epithets at the crowd? What were they doing? Now, a black woman was so offended by what they were doing, she contacted the mayor of Columbus and complained. What were they doing? They were eating bananas in the presence of a black woman. Now, why would that be offensive? I mean, think of what this black woman must have been, you know, correlating in her mind. Bananas. Anyway. Okay, so she complained to the mayor of Columbus, Georgia. She writes a letter. She calls in. She says, you know, listen, these guys out here, they were eating bananas in front of me. And you know what that makes me think of. But what did the mayor do? You know, if you got a call from a black woman who said, listen, two of your white cops were eating bananas. And they weren't, you know, making monkey faces. They weren't doing anything except eating a banana. They weren't doing anything else. What would you do if you were the mayor? Would you just toss that letter out and say, listen, some people are just crazy. What am I going to do? Would you give it a second thought? Of course not, if you're sane. What did the mayor of Columbus, Georgia do after hearing this complaint about two of his officers eating bananas? He wrote her a letter back, and he wrote this. Dear Mrs. Stewart, I am sorry that you found Columbus police officers eating bananas on the street when you arrived in Columbus for the protest. Let me assure you that there was no intent to offend you. The officers needed some nutrition after standing long hours on the street, and they particularly needed the potassium available in bananas. Accordingly, they were given these bananas along with some drinking water. There was no thought of insulting or offending anyone, and perhaps that was thoughtlessness on my part. In any case, let me offer to you my sincere apology for anything our officers may have done that gave offense to you or anyone else. I want to assure you that it will not happen again. I want to encourage you to come back to Columbus, Georgia, and get to know us better. You will find that this is a place where African Americans and all other people are valued equally and are welcome to full participation in community life. Again, I am sorry that you are offended, and I hope that you will accept my sincere apology. Respectfully, Robert F. Portishef, Mayor, Columbus, Georgia. This was in 2005. This goes to show. Now, you're thinking, okay, well, James, you're just, you know, you're picking out a couple of extreme examples of what racism, what's passing as racism today. No, you know, go to Google. Go to Google and set up a Google alert for racist and racism and see the stories that come in each day. I tell you, there's stuff that blew your mind. It blows your mind every day. And this is the mayor of Columbus, Georgia, and he wrote that letter back to that woman over a complaint like that. I mean, this guy makes John McCain look like Davy Crockett at the Alamo in comparison. But this is how far-reaching the paralysis is in white people. They're so scared of being called a name that they just, you know, they devolve into just quivering piles of jello. Absolutely spineless. The American flag's racist. A couple of examples that I used in my book. One took place at a hospital. One of the nurse supervisors had a American flag on her desk. The flag had been removed one day when she arrived at work because there had been complaints from African immigrants who had come into the hospital to get medical treatment. They saw the American flag and they said, you know, that's a racist flag. Now, how is the American flag, you know, it doesn't matter how or if. It just matters that they said it. And because they said the American flag was racist and they wanted it removed from the hospital, by God, it was. The American flag. Another example, in October of 2009 in Oregon, a fellow by the name of Jim Clausen was flying an American flag on the back of his motorcycle to show support for his son, who was in Iraq, and he was threatened with eviction if he didn't remove the flag because there were some minority residents there at the apartment that said that flag was offensive to them. So he put it down. We got to take a break. I'll be back with more right after this. Stay tuned. We gotta get out of this place.
Welcome back To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
And welcome back, everybody, to the first hour of tonight's live broadcast of the Political Cesspool Radio Program. James Edwards calling in tonight to our studio in Memphis via satellite, going out to Liberty News Radio Studio in Utah and to all of our affiliate stations, including our live internet simulcast. Whew, it's been a long 17 days, but an exciting 17 days. I'm a little tired, tongue getting twisted and all that, but I'm calling in tonight from Knoxville, Tennessee. And for the benefit of all of you fine people who did not have the chance to meet up with me at any stop along this tour this month that I've been doing, I'm sharing with you kind of a condensed version of the speech that I gave at each of these stops. And, of course, I'm talking about how the left uses accusations of racism to completely render useless white people. I mean, that's, I guess, you know, in a nutshell, what it is. I've been giving you some examples of what is passing as racism today. We've all heard the story from Maine, where a federal investigation was launched when some kids placed a ham sandwich near a Muslim student in the school cafeteria. Federal investigation for that kid. Students in Missouri were arrested and faced hate crime charges for dropping cotton balls on campus near a Black cultural center. A lawmaker in Texas was forced by a judge to apologize to one of his Black colleagues for using the term black hole in his presence, even though he was only describing the way the county was spending taxpayer money. All documented examples of what is passing as for racism and racists in 2011, yet still here we are, despite the fact that every other racial group and ethnic minority are not only allowed but encouraged to stand up and advance and safeguard their cultural heritage and group interests, yet we are here, and we will do nothing. You know, white people will not organize together. I mean, certainly my radio program is the exception, and there are exceptions to prove that rule, but by and large, we don't have the kind of racial solidarity that is so healthy and natural and is found so easily with all of these other groups. I envy them for that. But, you know, all of these instances that I've just given you just crack the surface of what is currently passing for racism in 2011. I won't even get into what isn't racism in 2011. Things like refusing to hire more qualified white applicants, as the city of St. Louis was recently found guilty of doing. The constant denigration of white athletes, using the media to constantly demonize and ridicule whites, banning white kids from college prep classes, as was done at one Illinois school a year or two back, and even the purposeful exclusion of whites from being candidates for scholarships, as the Bill Gates Foundation does. I mean, everybody knows about Bill Gates, the Microsoft billionaire, one of the most famous and richest men in the world. He wanted to give something back, so he set aside $1 billion out of his massive fortune to fund full four-year college scholarships for deserving young people. Well, that's pretty nice of him. But get this. Gates makes no bones about it. White kids are off limits. You, if you're white, you cannot apply for a Gates scholarship. It reads, and I quote, "Students are eligible to be considered for a Gates scholarship if they are African-American, American Indian, Alaska Native, Asian and Pacific Islander American, or Hispanic American," end quote. If you are white, they throw your application for a scholarship out. And so I see that kind of stuff. And I talk about it on the radio. I say, you know what, that obviously is blatantly unfair. That's blatantly racist in the true sense of the word. And I'm called racist, you know, for pointing things like this out each and every week. You know, and that takes gall. You know, Bill Gates is a white man, and the vast majority of the people who made him a multi-billionaire by buying his products were white, and he turns around and kicks us in the teeth like that. But, you know, that's not racism, according to, you know, the media in this day and age. It's racist if you think that, you know, racist. It can get confusing, I know. You know, let's talk about the Tea Party. You know, this is another, you know, perfect manifestation of implicit whiteness. yet, like so many others we've been learning about tonight, like John McCain, they're running around in circles. As I said earlier, liberals and race hustlers know that tossing out the R word is all they have to do to shut down conservative dissent. If you've been to a Tea Party rally over the course of the last year or two, you know that it's working. Instead of spending all of their time trying to roll back big government, the Tea Party speakers spend half of their time denying that they're racist, and the other half of it accusing the Democrats of being racist, which, of course, doesn't leave much time for rolling back big government or opposing socialist health care or anything else for that matter, which, as I said, is no accident. In fact, that's the whole point of this racism business, to keep us so busy trying to prove that we're not racist that we don't get the chance to accomplish anything. That's what it's all about. When the Tea Parties get really ambitious, they'll scour the crowd trying to find the minority to place on the stage, or they'll throw their support behind controlled opposition like Sarah Palin, but you know, they're blowing a wonderful opportunity to make a profound impact. You've got millions of people have gone to Tea Party rallies over the course of the last couple of years, and these are people who fundamentally agree with us on these issues. They're middle class, Christian, God-fearing, hard-working Americans. 99% of the Tea Party membership is white. But unlike everybody else who has such a strong and healthy sense of racial solidarity, you can have a strong, you can be white and be proud of it and want to, protect your family in the interest of others who share your history and culture and heroes and not hate anybody else. I have no hatred in my heart for anyone. But, the Tea Parties, you go there and there'll be 5,000 people there, 4,999 of them are white, and the other one is the guy talking on the stage to them, because they believe that their ideas can't be credible unless they're sanctioned by a non-white. And that's, folks, that's not healthy. The blacks and the Jews and the Hispanics, quite understandably, don't ask for our approval before they go out and try to make things better for their people. Why are we? What do we have to be ashamed of? So what are we going to do? First, as I've said in my book, and as I've said on these stops along the way over the course of the last 17 days, where I've taken this, outstanding and excellent speaking tour, first, you've got to understand one thing. As I've said, when a liberal says racist, they mean conservative white person. It's just their way of terrifying us into doing one of two things, which is either shutting up and withdrawing, which is what they really want, or wasting all of our time trying to prove that we're not racist instead of working on accomplishing our political goals. We've got to quit playing their game. If we're crying out loud, we've got to quit playing the pathetic token game, appointing unqualified affirmative action types to positions of leadership in conservatism is a recipe for disaster, as we've seen with Michael Steele, the head of the Republican Party, that buffoon. We've got the SCV, the Southern Heritage groups do it too. They trot out black people in Confederate uniforms as if the ideas that animated the South weren't legitimate unless they could find a black to sanction them. Quit playing the token game. Stop falling into the trap. And when they call you a racist, what they're going to do, if you're right of center, my goodness, look at John McCain, even if you're not. If you're politically involved at all and you're white, sooner or later you're going to be called a racist. It's just the way it works. It's too effective. Why wouldn't they do it? It works like a charm almost every time. Why would they stop? When you get it, don't deny it. Don't argue it. It doesn't matter what they think. They're not going to be with us anyway. Why do you want to win their approval? Don't try to prove that you're not a racist. Just laugh in their face. Counterattack. Point out that it's our people, the people who listen to the show. Whites in this country just want an equal and level playing field, equal rights for all, special privileges for none. It's the minority groups who want racist preferences like affirmative action, quotas, and set-asides. Tell them that they're the ones obsessed with race instead of what's best for our country. Never let them get you down. Never feel guilty for who you are or where you came from. If enough of us do that, what once was can be again, and what is will be no more. After all, what is love? I talked about love. A long time ago, I decided to get involved in this call. The day I got involved with this call was the day that I sealed my fate of never being able to make any real money. We live off the land. I work a full-time job. I do the show. and thankfully your support sustains the show, but I do all of this certainly not to benefit myself on this world with material goods. I do it because I love my family. I love my ancestors, and I want to defend that. What is love if not loving your own family a little bit more than others? You know, I don't hate anybody. But what kind of a person are you if you don't love your own family and those who share your heroes and heritage and culture a little bit more than strangers? You don't have to hate them. I don't hate anybody. But I love my own family just a little bit more. Doesn't that make sense? Does that make me a racist? You got to be explicitly pro-right and support others like us who are fighting on your behalf in the court of public opinion. No retreat, no surrender, no apology. That's what you do. Enough of us start doing that. If everybody in the Tea Party, you know, if I gave this speech to everybody that attended a Tea Party rally in 2010, things would change very quickly. If they had the opportunity to hear the press conference in Washington last week or the speeches today at this conference, things would change quickly. The people are out there. We've got to carry the message. That's what I'm trying to do. Appreciate your support. Got to take a break. We're going to talk to some of the other speakers here in Knoxville in the second and third hour. Stay tuned, folks. Just get started. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting, hallelujah. Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of the looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the amen.